Well, if it please your honors, my name is Jim Bull, 3213. And this is the first time I've been in your new edifice, and it's remarkable, I must say. I'm going to try to do the opening in 12 minutes and reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case is a somewhat phenomenal because we've now been up here twice, this being the second time, and the damages that were awarded were about $11,000. The first round, the U.S. Welding appealed because Judge Volek dismissed the case based upon a determination that Exhibit 23, which is a summary document, I'm going to talk about it, had no support in the record. And that Court of Appeals reversed as to oxygen and carbon dioxide and sent it back with an order was said that the court should consider damages from the point of view of sales of carbon dioxide and oxygen. When we went back to retry the case to Judge Wallach, who is now working at JAG, the plaintiff put on, re-offered Exhibit 23, and in Exhibit 23 told Judge Wallach, ignore the parts in there that don't count. And so they didn't put on anything new. The Exhibit 23, if you look at it in the record, has a very complicated column and sideways math that I challenged this court to try to figure it out. And somehow, Judge Volek figured it out.
Well, Mr. Bullock, as I understand the Court of Appeals opinion, the case was remanded because, in the opinion of the division, gross profits could be used as a measure of damages. And since they weren't used the first time around, since the damages calculation was based on net, they remanded it for a reconsideration.
That's very close, Your Honor. Our argument was that in Colorado, net profits is the measure of contract damages. And the Court of Appeals decided that I was right on the acetylene thing because there's lots of manufacturing that goes into it, and they didn't attempt to put on any evidence of what the net profit was. They just threw in their gross profit, gross sales. Same with oxygen and carbon dioxide. And at the retrial, we put on a lot of evidence to show that, in fact, there were a lot of expenses associated with the sale of those two products, so that gross profits should not be the measure of damages. Mr. Rios said in his brief, at page 22 of his brief, that we put on no evidence. He said there was no evidence to support any of our arguments. And he said that the judge rejected the defenses because if you read the judge's order, the first page was just the history of the case. On the second page, in one sentence, he says, I hereby find that these are the damages. Didn't even say why. And he didn't say whether net or gross or whatever. But this is a transcript printed out of all of our testimony, because the plaintiff didn't put on any evidence in the second trial other than reoffer Exhibit 23, which has the acetylene in it and cylinder rentals. And the one thing that's clear from the Court of Appeals order is that the only thing that the court was to consider was sale of gas, oxygen, and CO2.
Counsel, can I ask you a question about the Court of Appeals order since you're talking about it now? It seems as if the Court of Appeals remanded for reconsideration of the damages. Did the scope of the remand include reconsideration of defendant's liability?
Well, yes, because what Judge Volek did.
But I mean, in terms of the Court of Appeals remand order, did that include reconsideration of liability?
Well, liability, what it's kind of strange, because Judge Hagler, who first considered the legal issues, said this is a requirements contract. But he says the only thing in his order, he says the only thing that I'm discussing here is that it's a requirements contract and all of the defendant's defenses are still on the table for resolution. So that's what we were trying second round. We thought we were trying to defendant's defenses, which A, included whether this contract was even validly signed, because it wasn't. It was signed by a salesman when it says itself has to be signed by an executive. That was admitted by the on cross-examination, the second trial. And the breach, the prior breach, where there was at least three-quarters of the retrial case was testimony that we put on to show that the plaintiff had breached the contract all along. They admitted that they had two audits and had to change their accounting because their numbers were always wrong. They had to continue to re-invoice because their invoices were wrong. They were misbilling. There are two entities. One of them, and the other thing that's odd about the judge's order, Judge Fox's order, is he made the judgment joint and several. I mean, he combined the two as if they were one, instead of saying, okay, this entity is responsible for this, this entity is responsible for that. The other thing that was really odd is that half of the damages, including the rentals, which the Court of Appeals said was not part of the equation, half the damages were a projection into the future over 20 months. And Mr. Kirshner, who was representing the as a lay witness of the plaintiff, admitted that he didn't take the 08 recession into account, and he just did a straight line based upon 07 numbers and just projected out into the future. There was no basis for that. Ms. Boyd, who's here today, testified that in 09 and 2010, which were part of the projected damage period, their business had in 09, and it had again from 09 to 2010. So it went from a half to a quarter. When we asked Mr. Kirshner, well, did you take that into consideration? He said, no, I didn't. I just projected based upon what we thought was the case based upon 07 numbers. Mr. Hansen testified that they had laid off people, and this actually laid off 80 people from their business that were steel workers and 15 fabricators during those two-year projection figures that he was using. It didn't matter to him. One of the other oddball things about those damages were that in September or August, the salesman gave my clients new pricing because they were overpricing their product. They wanted to keep them. Mr. Kirshner admitted that they always changed their pricing by sending out a letter. You didn't have to have a new contract, they just sent out a letter. They gave them, that was Exhibit G. They didn't use Exhibit G in his projections. So, Exhibit 23 is an oddball exhibit. If you look at it, you can't figure it out. There's no way you can figure out what it is. It includes rentals, which were not part of the equation, according to the Court of Appeals. It includes the acetylene damages, which the Court of Appeals threw out, and they just said, ignore those things. And so they used the old piece of paper without trying to update anything.
Now, that isn't part of the opinion of the division in the Court of Appeals that Exhibit 23 should have been admitted in the first trial?
At the first trial, yes. And we We had, at the very beginning of this retrial, we had a long discourse that's in the transcript. And I said, you should not admit it at this point in time. You should take all the evidence and then consider all the evidence and then make a decision. But Judge Follett admitted it anyway. So we attacked it in our evidence. We went through and Ms. Boyd pointed out all arithmetic errors. Ms. Boyd pointed out that they had rentals in there when they're not supposed to have rentals. They didn't give any credit for leases. So there was a lot of that stuff that went on at the second retrial. Now, key to all of this.
But can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Judge Volek's order at the end of the second trial says he's awarding as damages profits relating to the sale of oxygen and carbon dioxide. You don't contend that he failed to exclude acetylene, do you?
Oh, I don't know what you can't tell from other than what you just quoted. Well,
that's what he said. So you can't show us that. You don't say that he necessarily included acetylene, said he didn't. You right. Say you can't replicate the computation that relates these damages, but if he did, why are we supposed to reverse that? If he didn't, he said he set forth net profits from that exhibit. We can't retry the case here.
But the reality is that you can't come up with that number with this document. That number was a number provided to the judge in the trial memorandum that was filed. And the major point in all of this is there's not one word in that one sentence order about any of the defenses. He doesn't say, Mr. Rhea says, well, he rejected it. Well, he didn't say I reject him. He didn't even say I considered it. All the testimony that we put on at that trial involved our defenses, which included the breach of contract. There's not one word. And then, of course, he lost all the exhibits.
As to that point, Judge Volek found a breach of contract at the end of the first trial. He did say that there was a breach of contract, right?
He quoted from Judge Haglund's order.
No, that there was it was a requirements contract.
He said he was taking Judge Haglund's order as the law of the case.
You didn't appeal that.
No.
Or cross appeal that.
But we had Judge Haglund said all of the defenses, which included breach, which is a defense, an affirmative defense, were still on the table.
And didn't Judge Volek rule on that at the end of the trial?
No, he didn't rule on any of those. There's not one word in his order regarding any of the defenses. That's the primary reason we appealed this case. If you read his order, there is not one sentence, not one word, that there were affirmative defenses that he was ruling on. So I say I have a minute and 50 seconds, and I'll use that on the bottle.
All right, Mr. Ball.
May it please the court, John Reha, registration number 11800 for the plaintiff appellee, United States Welding. Perhaps I can set some of the records straight here. I listened closely to Mr. Bull's oral argument, and what he's really attacking is a foundation for Exhibit 23. This court's opinion on the first appeal found that the support documents for Exhibit 23 were admitted without objection. So any issue as to those on a foundation basis was waived. Now, what Mr. Bull referred to in terms of our readmission effort at phase two of the trial is not quite complete. What he said was he did not object to the exhibit coming in. He didn't. What he said was, I think it's proper to do this after we present our testimony, but Judge, you can do whatever you want to do. I'm paraphrasing, but I'm within two or three words of being verbatim. Excuse me. So, do we even have preservation of error here as the foundation for Exhibit 23? No, we don't. The objection needed to be made. Voir dire needed to be done. And that simply wasn't the case. So, Exhibit 23 is in, as this court has noted today, this court's own opinion the last time said that Exhibit 23 should have been entered because Rule of Evidence 1006 was substantially complied with. Foundation did exist. That's law of this case. In fact, it's appellate law of this case, that Foundation exists for the exhibit. So one of you asked whether or not that issue was preserved. No, it wasn't. If that was a determination of the court the first time around, or if it was a determination of this court on the first appeal, there should have at least been a motion to reconsider filed in this court to get that issue resolved, but it was never done. Judge Hagelin's order. Another key part of the appellant's argument here is that Judge Hagelin's order kept the affirmative defenses alive and specifically said so. That's not true. What Judge Hagelin's order said, I quote, "The court finds that genuine issues of material fact remain with respect to the duration of the contracts. Any alleged breaches, the scope of such breaches, and damages incurred as a result of the breaches," unquote.
And those issues were tried before Judge Abalek the first time?
No, the affirmative defenses were not. We were dismissed at the end of our case in chief. So, at least for Judge Hagelin, he didn't include that as an issue that remained. But if that was error on Judge Hagelin's part, it should have been part of the first appeal. If his order wasn't correct at that point in time, that order was entered well in advance of the first trial.
Well, as I understand Mr. Bull's brief,
mm-hmm.
One of his contentions is that the order that Volek enters, the judgment, is defective because he doesn't comply with Rule 52. It doesn't make any findings of fact, and yet he takes a day and a half, or perhaps almost 2 days, of testimony with respect to affirmative defenses, but the order silent as to any of those affirmative defenses. That's what I understand him to argue in his brief. How do you respond to that?
I would agree that's one of his arguments. Does Justice Volek refer to the affirmative defenses? No, he doesn't. Here's his order. I've got it in my hand. And he doesn't refer to it there. However, he does, on page 2, specifically refer, I'll quote, "The court has reviewed the closing briefs of the plaintiff," ours is 15 pages long, "and the defendants," they have a total of 31 pages, "where all of this is set out in detail, and enters the following findings, conclusions, and orders." So did he consider it? Yeah, he did. And unless we're going to somehow attribute to Justice Volek, he's not being truthful with us. I mean, that's what he said. He considered that. Does he state that he rejects the affirmative defenses? No. I've seen a ton of trial court orders where not every affirmative defense is addressed. I'm sure you have too, and it typically isn't grounds for reversal. That happens all the time. What are the affirmative defenses? Invalid contract. That's not even an affirmative defense. The element of a contract breach is to establish that a contract exists. Judge Hagelin found that on summary judgment. That issue has been resolved literally for 4 years. Estoppel and prior breach. By the way, Mr. Bull stated that I set out in my brief, just at this point, that we stated that there was no evidence that the defendants presented. Actually, what our statement was is there was no evidence to support a viable affirmative defense, and that's true. Now, if we're going to go to the issue of prior breach, there's been no argument here. There's been no evidence pointed out to you on appeal at all that there's any breach that goes to the heart of the relationship. And that's what we have to have. There might be some billing errors here and there, but that's not sufficient. The standard at that point is there some competent evidence to support the trial judge's determination of damages. Yes, there is. As a matter of fact, this court's own opinion said so. That's the only issue. So does he even need to get to that affirmative defense? No, he doesn't. Estoppel, It's the same argument, is that we were billing for the wrong things. Well, what is that? That's calculation. And we go all the way back, again, to this court's own opinion. That issue's already been resolved. So, to address your question about Rule 52, I think Rule 52 is met. Does he specifically mention the affirmative defenses by name? No, he doesn't. But the issue should be, is there sufficient evidence in the record to support reversal based upon clear error?
Well, is there sufficient evidence in the record to support his decision, his finding that there was $11,469 in damages? And your position is that evidence is found in Exhibit 23?
Yes.
And the underlying documents?
That's
you
right.
Put no testimony on to support.
Pardon?
You put no testimony on, as I understand it, at the last trial to support that number. You just put the exhibit in.
We removed anything having to do with the settlement.
Okay. Whether you did or not. Okay.
But we did.
Did you put evidence out of the first trial to support that exhibit, I assume?
Yes.
Was that somehow incorporated? I mean, that was known to Judge Bollock, wasn't it? He could have relied on that testimony, could he not?
Oh, sure. What we tried to do was to follow this court's instruction, which is Exhibit 23 was offered by us at the very end of this, and we knew going in that there was going to be an issue about gross versus net profit. We knew that. We actually told Justice Bollock that in our opening statement and said that's going to be the big issue today.
Mm-hmm.
And our position is that when you have just a minimal difference in your overhead, which is basically pulling a truck into the yard once or twice a week, that you don't need to count that. And we accepted this court's opinion that on a settlement, because there's manufacturing involved, you need to include additional costs. But here's the point I want to get at. If you look at the briefing that's been done by the appellant here, a good share of the real estate in that brief is consumed by this point, and that is you should have to relook at all of this all over again, things that were already resolved back on the first trial.
Right.
That what the appellants want to have happen here is to blow this entire case to smithereens and start all over again. Well, we took this court's remand instructions to heart, which is, okay, you guys were done. You moved to admit the exhibit. The judge didn't allow it for one reason, not because of lack of foundation, but because you guys didn't include
net profits.
Yeah, and so this court said, well, that's not correct in that situation for oxygen and carbon dioxide. It should have been admitted. So we went back to phase two. We'd already rested. It wouldn't have been fair for us to try to put in more evidence. I think that would have been improper. We rested upon what we have, so we just moved for admission of Exhibit 23.
So is it your position then that Exhibit 23 shows gross profits with respect to oxygen and carbon dioxide, and that's a proper measure of damages per the order of this prior order of this division of this court?
Yes, it is. And this completely number, in line with this court's.
And the number 11,469 it's not found on Exhibit 23, but I guess it can be deciphered from Exhibit 23.
Yeah, to pull a settlement out. Yes.
Okay.
And just to follow up on that. Again, this appeal includes a lot of argument that you should look at cost of manufacture of oxygen and carbon dioxide. Well, that issue's been out of this case since the first appeal, clearly. That's not even an issue anymore. Rule 52, if I might. It includes language that says, findings of facts will not be set aside unless clearly erroneous. And due regard should be given to the opportunity of the trial court to judge credibility of the witnesses. And that's something we're forgetting here, is that Justice Bollock was in a unique position to do that. He tried the entire case. And we don't believe there is any error here at all. We say that for a number of reasons, but included in that is the reality that we're dealing with an abuse of discretion clear error standard here. And ultimately, we're dealing with the question of damages. And in damages, that standard is extremely strong in favor of the successful party, and that is if there is some evidence in the record that supports the damages, they can't be reversed. Is there some? Yes, I think this court's own opinion supports that very point. There is some. Adequate foundation was laid for Exhibit 23. We don't believe there's any error. But if this court should find something needs to be done, it isn't appropriate to blow up this entire case and have it retried, and that's what the appellants are asking you to do. So Judge Hagelin's order, I guess, goes out. Judge Bollock's decision from trial round one goes out. And this court's own opinion goes out because now it's moot. So we don't have a controversy that it determined. And if that is the case, and I think one of the real underlying problems here is that the defendants never objected to Exhibit 23 on admission, and they never objected to the support documents on admission. That second point is in this court's opinion. But on retrial, the same thing happened, because that's, again, the statement the counsel made, I guess you can do what you want to do. And they were reserving their arguments for their case in chief. Well, if we're going to allow a retrial, then the defense is going to be allowed this time to object upon admission, which is what they should have done first time. And something's being forgotten in the appellant's argument. They argue fairness, 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 but only to them. What about fairness to me and my client? What about fairness to U.S. Willing? We played by the rules. And we should be able, it's our right, to be able to rest at this stage in this case upon the fact that the defense didn't object to our exhibit. So if this court does remand, it should remand back to Judge Hawley. We have an agreement that he is the one who's supposed to deal with this until it's finalized. There's no evidence, no argument here that he can't do it. And there should also be instructions that the defense cannot object to Exhibit 23's admission and cannot object to admission of the support documents which underlie it, because those matters have already been done. Those objections weren't made.
Mr. Rehub, I hate to bring this up.
Yep.
But how could we remand back to Judge Volokh if he's a judge that sits by designation?
Well, he's a judge pro tem. And Mr. Bull and I both struggled with this because we didn't know what is a judge pro tem and what do they do. But a judge pro tem upon appointment by Chief Justice Bender is given all the authority of any other trial judge. And we perhaps have a novel issue here about whether or not remand can go back to a pro tem judge. I don't know why it can't. The pro tem judge provisions absolutely don't provide for this. I mean, we are all in frontier territory here. I will admit that to you, but I think you do have the authority to do it. But if we're going to remand to anybody, then we should have those restrictions in. I am out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reha. Mr. Bull, you've got a little less than 2 minutes.
Just a couple of things. Your Honors, I did object twice. I objected at the first hearing. That's why Judge Volokh dismissed the case. At the second hearing, we both wrote out pre-trial memorandums. I objected in that memorandum. That was the exact very discussion that we took up at the very beginning of the hearing. And what I said was, the court, in its discretion, will do whatever the court wants to do. But I object. I didn't say I object, because I already had objected, and Mr. Rio was taking the position that the document was in by itself based upon the Court of Appeals decision. Secondly, we put on two witnesses regarding the manufacture of oxygen and carbon dioxide. One of the things that's interesting in this case is there was no rebuttal whatsoever. All of our testimony
was the purpose of those witnesses to show that
the measure of profits should not have been gross, but should have been net? That was the purpose of the witness?
Yes, because...
But the Court of Appeals Division said it could be gross.
Well, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals was acting as a trial judge at that point where it was taking the position that that there were no manufacturing involved in those gases. Keep in mind, I didn't even put on any testimony on that issue because I never got there.
So your position was the division's opinion was erroneous in that regard?
It was clearly erroneous. They were playing trial judge. Roy was.
Counsel, you didn't appeal the Court of Appeals earlier division order, right?
Oh, because over $11,000, I don't want to take up the court's time, but I will say this. Exhibit 23, if you add up two columns for the gases that we're talking about, CO2 was $1,669 and for BNC and $1,053 for Metro. Now, how do you get to 11,000, whatever it was, when their very own document says 2632.75 and 1053.96?
Thank you, Mr. Ball.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Ria. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.